Chapter 10 Life in the Clearings versus the Bush by Susanna Moody. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Grace Marks.
I dare not think, I cannot pray, to name the name of God were sin. No grief of mine can wash away the consciousness of guilt within. The stain of blood is on my hand, the curse of Cain is on my brow. I see that ghastly phantom stand between me and the sunshine now. That mocking face still haunts my dreams, that bloodshot eye that never sleeps. In night and darkness, oh, it gleams like red-hot steel, but never weeps. And still it bends its burning gaze on mine till drops of terror start from my hot brow, and hell's fierce blaze is kindled in my brain and heart. I long for death, yet dare not die, though life is now a weary curse. But oh, that dread eternity may bring a punishment far worse.
So much has been written about the city of Kingston, so lately the seat of government, and so remarkable for its fortifications, and the importance it ever must be to the colony, as a military depot and place of defence, that it is not my intention to enter into a minute description of it here. I was greatly pleased, as I think every stranger must be, with its general aspect, particularly as seen from the water, in which respect it has a great advantage over Toronto. The number of vessels lying at the different wharfs, and the constant arrival of noble steamers from both the United States and the upper and lower province, give it a very business-like appearance. Yet, upon landing, you are struck with the want of stir and bustle in the principal thoroughfares, when contrasted with the size and magnitude of the streets. The removal of the seat of government has checked the growth of Kingston for a while, but you feel, while examining its commanding position, that it must always be the key of the upper province, the great rallying point in case of war or danger. The market house is a very fine building, and the wants of the city could be supplied within its area, were it three times the size that it is at present. The market is decidedly one of the chief attractions of the place. The streets are wide and well paved, and there are a great many fine trees in and about Kingston, which give to it the appearance of a European town. The houses are chiefly of brick and stone along the public thoroughfares, and there are many neat private dwellings enclosed in trim, well-kept gardens. The road leading to the provincial penitentiary runs parallel with the water and forms a delightful drive. It is about 3 years ago that I paid a visit with my husband to the penitentiary, and went over every part of it. I must own that I felt a greater curiosity to see the convicts than the prison which contained them, and my wishes were completely gratified, as my husband was detained for several hours on business, and I had a long interval of leisure to examine the workshops where the convicts were employed at their different trades, their sleeping cells, chapel, and places of punishment. The silence system is maintained here, no conversation being allowed between the prisoners. I was surprised at the neatness, cleanliness, order, and regularity of all the arrangements in the vast building, and still more astonished that 40 or 50 strong, active-looking men, unfettered, with the free use of their limbs, could be controlled by one person who sat on a tall chair as overseer of each ward. In several instances, particularly in the tailoring and shoemaking department, the overseers were small, delicate-looking men, but such is the force of habit and the want of moral courage which generally accompanies guilt, that a word or look from these men was sufficient to keep them at work. The dress of the male convicts was warm and comfortable, though certainly not very elegant, consisting, for it was late in the fall, of a thick woolen jacket, one side of it being brown, the other yellow, with trousers to correspond, a shirt of coarse factory cotton, but very clean, and good stout shoes, and warm knitted woolen socks. The letters PP for Provincial Penitentiary are sewed in coloured cloth upon the dark side of the jacket. Their hair is cut very short to the head, and they wear a cloth cap of the same colors that compose their dress. The cells are narrow, just wide enough to contain a small bed, a stool, and a washbowl, and the prisoners are divided from each other by thick stone walls. They are locked in every night at 6 o'clock, and their cell is so constructed that one of the keepers can always look in upon the convict without his being aware of the scrutiny. The bedding was scrupulously clean, and I saw a plain Bible in each cell. There is a sort of machine resembling a stone coffin in which mutinous convicts are confined for a given time. They stand in an upright position, and as there are air holes for breathing, the look and name of the thing is more dreadful than the punishment, which cannot be the least painful. I asked the gentleman who showed us over the building what country sent the most prisoners to the penitentiary. He smiled and told me, "Guess." I did so, but was wrong. "No," said he, "we have more French Canadians and men of color than Irish, English, and runaway loafers from the States. Of the Scotch we have very few, but they are very bad, the most ungovernable, sullen, and disobedient. When a Scotchman is bad enough to be brought here, he is like Jeremiah's bad figs, only fit for the gallows." Mr. Moody's bailiffs had taken down a young fellow, about 20 years of age, who had been convicted at the assizes for stealing curious coins from a person who had brought them out to this country as old family relics. The evidence was more circumstantial than positive, and many persons believed the lad innocent. He had kept up his spirits bravely on the voyage, and was treated with great kindness by the men who had him in custody. But when once within the massy walls of the huge building, his courage seemed to forsake him all at once. We passed him as he sat on the bench, while the barber was cutting his hair and shaving off his whiskers. His handsome suit had been removed. He was in the party-colored dress before described. There was in his face an expression of great anguish, and tears were rolling in quick succession down his cheeks. Poor fellow! I should hardly have known him again, so completely was he humbled by his present position. Mr. M.Y. told me that they had some men in the penitentiary who had returned 3 different times to it, and had grown so attached to their prison that they preferred being there, well clothed and well fed, to gaining a precarious living elsewhere. Executions in Canada are so rare, even for murder, that many atrocious criminals are found within these walls, men and women, who could not possibly have escaped the gallows in England. At 12 o'clock I followed Mr. M. to the great hall to see the prisoners dine. The meal consisted of excellent soups, with a portion of the meat which had been boiled in it, potatoes and brown bread, all very clean and good of their kind. I took a plate of the soup and a piece of the bread, and enjoyed both greatly. I could not help thinking, while watching these men in their comfortable dresses, taking their wholesome, well-cooked meal, how much better they were fed and lodged than thousands of honest, industrious men who had maintained large families upon a crust of bread in the great manufacturing cities at home. Most of these men had very bad countenances, and I never felt so much convinced of the truth of phrenology as while looking at their heads. The extraordinary formation, or rather malformation, of some of them led me to think that their possessors were hardly accountable for their actions. One man in particular, who had committed a very atrocious murder and was confined for life, had a most singular head, such as one, indeed, as I never saw before on a human body. It was immensely large at the base, and appeared perfectly round, while at the crown it rose to a point like a sugar loaf. He was of dull, drab-colored complexion, with large, prominent eyes of a pale green color, his expression the most repulsively cruel and sinister. The eye involuntarily singled him out, among all his comrades, as something too terrible to escape observation. Among such a number of men, 448, who were there present, I was surprised at seeing so few with red or fair hair. I noticed this to my companion. He had never observed it before, but said it was strange. The convicts were mostly of a dull, grey complexion, large-eyed, stolid-looking men, or with very black hair and heavy black brows. I could only account for the circumstance from the fact that though fair-haired people are often violently passionate and easily excited, their anger is sudden and quick, never premeditated, but generally the work of the moment. Like straw on a fire, it kindles into a fierce blaze, but it is over in an instant. They seldom retain it or bear malice. Not so the dull, putty-colored, sluggish man. He is slow to act, but he broods over a supposed affront or injury and never forgets it. He plans the moment of retaliation and stabs his enemy when least prepared. There were many stolid, heavy-looking men in that prison, many with black, jealous, fiery-looking eyes, in whose gloomy depths suspicion and revenge seemed to lurk. Even to look at these men as they passed on seemed to arouse their vindictive feelings, and they scowled disdainfully upon us as they walked on to their respective places. There was one man among these dark, fierce-looking criminals who, from his proud carriage and bearing, particularly arrested my attention. I pointed him out to Mr. Blank. That man has the appearance of an educated person. He looks as if he had been a gentleman. You are right, was his reply. He was a gentleman, the son of a district judge, and brought up to the law. A clever man, too, but these walls do not contain a worse in every respect. He was put in here for arson and an attempt to murder. Many a poor man has been hung with half his guilt. There are two men near him, I said, who have not the appearance of criminals at all. What have they done? They are not felons, but two soldiers put here for a week for disorderly conduct. What a shame, I cried, to degrade them in this manner. What good can it do? Oh, said he, laughing, it will make them desert to the States the moment they get out. And those two little boys, what are they here for? For murder, whispered he. I almost sprang from my seat. It appeared too dreadful to be true. Yes, he continued, that child to the right is in for shooting his sister, the other to the left for killing a boy of his own age with a hoe and burying him under the roots of a fallen tree. Both of these boys come from the neighbourhood of Peterborough. Your district, by the by, sends fewer convicts to the penitentiary than any part of the upper province. It was with great pleasure I heard him say this. During a residence of 13 years at Belleville, there has not been one execution. The county of Hastings is still unsustained with the blood of a criminal. There is so little robbery committed in this part of the country that the thought of thieves or housebreakers never for a moment disturbs our rest. This is not the case in Hamilton and Toronto, whose daring acts of housebreaking are of frequent occurrence. The constant influx of runaway slaves from the States has added greatly to the criminal lists on the frontier. The addition of these people to our population is not much to be coveted. The slave, from his previous habits and education, does not always make a good citizen. During the last assizes at Cobourg, a black man and his wife were condemned to be hung for a most horrible murder, and their son, a young man of 20 years of age, offered the sheriff to hang his own father and mother for a new suit of clothes. Those who laud the black man and place him above the white, let them produce in the whole annals of human crime a more atrocious one than this. Yet it was not a hanging matter. I heard a gentleman exclaim, with honest indignation, when this anecdote was told in his hearing, "If a man were wanting to hang that monster, I would do it myself." But leaving the male convicts, I must now introduce my reader to the female inmates of this house of woe and crime. At the time of my visit, there were only 40 women in the penitentiary. This speaks much for the superior moral training of the feebler sex. My chief object in visiting their department was to look at the celebrated murderess, Grace Marks, of whom I had heard a great deal, not only from the public papers, but from the gentleman who defended her upon her trial, and whose able pleading saved her from the gallows, on which her wretched accomplice closed his guilty career. As many of my English readers may never have heard even the name of this remarkable criminal, it may not be uninteresting to them to give a brief sketch of the events which placed her here. About 8 or 9 years ago, I write from memory, and am not very certain as to dates. A young Irish emigrant girl was hired into the service of Captain Kinnaird, an officer on half pay, who had purchased a farm about 30 miles in the rear of Toronto. But the name of the township and the county in which it was situated I have forgotten. But this is of little consequence to my narrative. Both circumstances could be easily ascertained by the curious. The captain had been living for some time on very intimate terms with his housekeeper, a handsome young woman of the name of Hannah Montgomery, who had been his servant of all work. Her familiarity with her master, who, it appears, was a very fine-looking, gentlemanly person, had rendered her very impatient of her former menial employments, and she soon became virtually the mistress of the house. Grace Marks was hired to wait upon her, and perform all the coarse drudgery that Hannah considered herself too fine a lady to do. While Hannah occupied the parlour with her master, and sat at his table, her insolent airs of superiority aroused the jealousy and envy of Grace Marks, and the manservant Macdermot, who considered themselves quite superior to their self-elected mistress. Macdermot was the son of respectable parents, but from being a wild, ungovernable boy, he had become a bad, vicious man, and early abandoned the parental roof to enlist for a soldier. He was soon tired of his new profession, and, deserting from his regiment, escaped detection and emigrated to Canada. Having no means of his own, he was glad to engage with Captain Kinnaird as a servant, to whom his character and previous habits were known. These circumstances, together with what follows, were drawn from his confession, made to Mr. Mackey, who had conducted his defence the night previous to his execution. Perhaps it will be better to make him the narrator of his own story. Grace Marks was hired by Captain Kinnaird to wait upon his housekeeper a few days after I entered his service. She was a pretty girl, and very smart about her work, but of a silent, sullen temper. It was very difficult to know when she was pleased. Her age did not exceed 17 years. After the work of the day was over, she and I generally were left to ourselves in the kitchen, Hannah being entirely taken up with her master. Grace was very jealous of the difference made between her and the housekeeper, whom she hated, and to whom she was often very insolent and saucy. Her whole conversation to me was on this subject. "What is she better than us?" She would say that she is to be treated like a lady, and eat and drink of the best. She is not better born than we are, or better educated. I will not stay here to be domineered over by her. Either she or I must soon leave this. Every little complaint Hannah made of me was repeated to me with cruel exaggerations, till my dander was up, and I began to regard the unfortunate woman as our common enemy. The good looks of Grace had interested me in her cause, and though there was something about the girl that I could not exactly like, I had been a very lawless, dissipated fellow, and if a woman was young and pretty, I cared very little about her character. Grace was sullen and proud, and not very easily won over to my purpose, but in order to win her liking, if possible, I gave a ready ear to all her discontented repinings. One day Captain Kinnaird went to Toronto to draw his half-year's pay, and left word with Hannah that he would be back by noon the next day. She had made some complaint against us to him, and he had promised to pay us off on his return. This had come to the ears of Grace, and her hatred to the housekeeper was increased to a tenfold degree. I take heaven to witness that I had no designs against the life of the unfortunate woman when my master left the house. Hannah went out in the afternoon to visit some friends she had in the neighbourhood, and left Grace and I alone together. This was an opportunity too good to be lost, and, instead of minding our work, we got to recapitulating our fancied wrongs over some of the captain's whisky. I urged my suit to Grace, but she would not think of anything, or listen to anything, but the insults and injuries she had received from Hannah, and her burning thirst for revenge. "Dear me," said I, half in jest, "if you hate her so much as all that, say but the word, and I will soon rid you of her for ever." I had not the least idea that she would take me at my word, Her eyes flashed with a horrible light. "You dare not do it," she replied, with a scornful toss of the head. "Dare not do what?" "Kill that woman for me," she whispered. "You don't know what I dare or I daren't do," said I, drawing a little back from her. "If you will promise to run off with me afterwards, I will see what I can do with her." "I'll do anything you like, but you must first kill her."
"You are not in earnest, Grace."
"I mean what I say."
"How shall we be able to accomplish it? She is away now, and she may not return before her master comes back."
"Never doubt her. She will be back to see after the house, and that we are in no mischief."
"She sleeps with you?"
"Not always. She will tonight."
"I will wait till you are asleep, and then I will kill her with a blow of the axe on the head. It will be over in a minute. Which side of the bed does she lie on?"
"She always sleeps on the side nearest the wall, and she bolts the door the last thing before she puts out the light. But I will manage both these difficulties for you. I will pretend to have a toothache very bad, and will ask to sleep next the wall tonight. She is kind to the sick, and will not refuse me, and after she is asleep, I will steal out at the foot of the bed and unbolt the door. If you are true to your promise, you need not fear that I shall neglect mine." I looked at her with astonishment. "Good God," thought I, "can this be a woman? A pretty, soft-looking woman, too, and a mere girl. What a heart she must have." I felt equally tempted to tell her she was a devil, and that I would have nothing to do with such a horrible piece of business. But she looked so handsome that somehow or another I yielded to the temptation, though it was not without a struggle, for conscience loudly warned me not to injure one who had never injured me. Hannah came home to supper, and she was unusually agreeable, and took her tea with us in the kitchen, and laughed and chatted as merrily as possible. And Grace, in order to hide the wicked thoughts working in her mind, was very pleasant too. And they went laughing to bed, as if they were the best friends in the world. I sat by the kitchen fire after they had gone, with the axe between my knees, trying to harden my heart to commit the murder. But for a long time I could not bring myself to do it. I thought over all my past life. I had been a bad, disobedient son, a dishonest, wicked man, but I had never shed blood. I had often felt sorry for the error of my ways, and had even vowed amendment, and prayed God to forgive me, and make a better man of me for the time to come. And now, here I was, at the instigation of a young girl, contemplating the death of a fellow creature with whom I had been laughing and talking on apparently friendly terms a few minutes ago. Oh, it was dreadful, too dreadful to be true. And then I prayed God to remove the temptation from me and to convince me of my sin. "Ah, but," whispered the devil, "Grace Marks will laugh at you. She will twit you with your want of resolution and say that she is the better man of the two." I sprang up and hastened at the door, which opened into the kitchen. All was still. I tried the door. For the damnation of my soul, it was open. I had no need of a candle. The moon was at full. There was no curtain to their window, and it shone directly upon the bed, and I could see their features as plainly as by the light of day. Grace was either sleeping or pretending to sleep. I think the latter, for there was a sort of fiendish smile upon her lips. The housekeeper had yielded to her request, and was lying with her head out over the bedclothes, in the best possible manner for receiving a death-blow upon her temples. She had a sad, troubled look upon her handsome face, and once she moved her hand and said, "Oh, dear!" I wonder whether she was dreaming of any danger to herself and the man she loved. I raised the axe to give the death-blow, but my arm seemed held back by an invisible hand. It was the hand of God. I turned away from the bed and left the room. I could not do it. I sat down by the embers of the fire and cursed my own folly. I made a second attempt, a third, and fourth, yes, even to a ninth, and my purpose was each time defeated. God seemed to fight for the poor creature, and the last time I left the room I swore with a great oath that if she did not die till I killed her, she might live on to the day of judgment. I threw the axe onto the wood heap in the shed and went to bed, and soon fell fast asleep. In the morning I was coming into the kitchen to light the fire, and met Grace Marks with the pails in her hand,
going out to milk the cows. As she passed me, she gave me a poke with the pail in the rib, and whispered with a sneer, "Aren't you a coward?" As she uttered those words, the devil against whom I had fought all night entered into my heart, and transformed me into a demon. All feelings of remorse and mercy forsook me from that instant, and darker and deeper plans of murder and theft flashed through my brain. "Go and milk the cows," said I with a bitter laugh, "and you shall soon see whether I am the coward you take me for." She went out to milk, and I went in to murder the unsuspicious housekeeper. I found her at the sink in the kitchen, washing her face in a tin basin. I had the fatal axe in my hand, and without pausing for an instant to change my mind, for had I stopped to think, she would have been living to this day, I struck her a heavy blow on the back of the head with my axe. She fell to the ground at my feet without uttering a word, and, opening the trap door that led from the kitchen into a cellar, where we kept potatoes and other stores, I hurled her down, closed the door, and wiped away the perspiration that was streaming down my face. I then looked at the axe and laughed. "Yes, I have tasted blood now, and this murder will not be the last. Grace Marks, you have raised the devil. Take care of yourself now." She came in with her pails, looking as innocent and demure as the milk they contained. She turned pale when her eye met mine. I have no doubt but that I looked the fiend her taunt had made me. "Where's Hannah?" she asked in a faint voice. "Dead," said I. "What, are you turned coward now?" "MacDermot, you look dreadful. I am afraid of you, not of her." "Aha, my girl, you should have thought of that before. The hound that laps blood once will lap again. You have taught me how to kill, and I don't care who or how many I kill now. When Kennard comes home, I will put a ball through his brain and send him to keep company below with the housekeeper." She put the pails down, she sprang towards me, and clinging to my arm, exclaimed in frantic tones, "You won't kill him?" "By blank, I will. Why should he escape more than Hannah? And hark you, girl, if you dare to breathe a word to anyone of my intention, or tell to anyone, by word or sign, what I have done, I will kill you." She trembled like a leaf. Yes, that young demon trembled. "Don't kill me," she whined. "Don't kill me, MacDermot. I swear that I will not betray you, and oh, don't kill him." "And why the devil do you want me to spare him? He is so handsome." "Pshaw! So good-natured, especially to you. Come, Grace, no nonsense. If I had thought that you were jealous of your master and Hannah, I would have been the last man on earth to have killed her. You belong to me now, and though I believe that the devil has given me a bad bargain in you, yet, such as you are, I will stand by you. And now strike a light and follow me into the cellar. You must help me to put Hannah out of sight." She never shed a tear, but she looked dogged and sullen, and did as I bid her. That cellar presented a dreadful spectacle. I can hardly bear to recall it now, but then, when my hands were still red with blood, it was doubly terrible. Hannah Montgomery was not dead as I had thought. The blow had only stunned her. She had partially recovered her senses, and was kneeling on one knee as we descended the ladder with the light. I don't know if she heard us, for she must have been blinded with the blood that was flowing down her face. But she certainly heard us, and raised her clasped hands as if to implore mercy. I turned to Grace. The expression of her livid face was even more dreadful than that of the unfortunate woman. She uttered no cry, but she put her hand to her head and said, "God has damned me for this." "Then you have nothing more to fear," says I. "Give me that handkerchief off your neck." She gave it without a word. I threw myself on the body of the housekeeper, and planting my knee on her breast, I tied the handkerchief round her throat in a single tie, giving Grace one end to hold, while I drew the other tight enough to finish my terrible work. Her eyes literally started from her head. She gave one groan, and all was over. I then cut the body in four pieces, and turned a large wash-tub over them. "Now, Grace, you may come up and get my breakfast." "Yes, Mr. M. You will not perhaps believe me. Yet I assure you that we went upstairs and ate a good breakfast, and I laughed with Grace at the consternation the captain would be in when he found that Hannah was absent. During the morning, a peddler called, who travelled the country with second-hand articles of clothing, taking farm produce in exchange for his wares. I bought of him 2 good linen-breasted shirts, which had been stolen from some gentleman by his housekeeper. While I was chatting with the peddler, I remarked that Grace had left the house, and I saw her through the kitchen window talking to a young lady by the well, who often came across to borrow an old gun from my master to shoot ducks. I called to her to come in, which she appeared to me to do very reluctantly. I felt that I was in her power, and I was horribly afraid of her betraying me in order to save her own and the captain's life. I now hated her from my very soul, and could have killed her without the least pity or remorse. "What do you want, McDermott?" she said sullenly. "I want you. I dare not trust you out of my sight. I know what you are. You are plotting mischief against me, but if you betray me, I will be revenged, if I have to follow you to blank for that purpose." "Why do you doubt my word, McDermott? Do you think I want to hang myself? No, not yourself, but me. You are too bad to be trusted. What were you saying just now to that boy?" "I told him that the captain was not at home, and I dared not lend him the gun." "You were right. The gun will be wanted at home." She shuddered and turned away. It seems that she had had enough of blood, and showed some feeling at last. I kept my eye upon her, and would not suffer her for a moment out of my sight. At noon the captain drove into the yard, and I went out to take the horse. Before he had time to alight, he asked for Hannah. I told him that she was out, that she went off the day before and had not returned, but that we expected her in every minute. He was very much annoyed, and said that she had no business to leave the house during his absence, that he would give her a good rating when she came home. Grace asked if she should get his breakfast. He said he wanted none. He would wait till Hannah came back, and then he would take a cup of coffee. He then went into the parlour, and throwing himself down upon the sofa, commenced reading a magazine he had brought with him from Toronto. "I thought he would miss the young lady," said Grace. "He has no idea how close she is to him at this moment. I wonder why I could not make him as good a cup of coffee as Hannah. I have often made it for him, when he did not know it. But what is sweet from her hand would be poison from mine. But I have had my revenge." Dinner time came, and out came the captain to the kitchen, book in hand. "Is Hannah back yet?" "No, sir." "It's strange. Which way did she go?" "She did not tell us where she was going, but said that, as you were out, it would be a good opportunity of visiting an old friend." "When did she say she would be back?" "We expected her last night," said Grace. "Something must have happened to the girl, McDermott," turning to me. "Put the saddle on my riding horse, and I will go among the neighbors and inquire if they have seen her." Grace exchanged glances with me. "Will you not stay till after dinner, sir?" "I don't care," he cried impatiently. "A blank for dinner. I feel too uneasy about the girl to eat. McDermott, be quick and saddle Charlie, and you, Grace, come and tell me when he is at the door." He went back into the parlour and put on his riding coat, and I went into the harness house, not to obey his orders, but to plan his destruction. I perceived that it was more difficult to conceal a murder than I had imagined, that the inquiries he was about to make would arouse suspicion among the neighbours, and finally lead to a discovery. The only way to prevent this was to murder him, take what money he had brought with him from Toronto, and be off with Grace to the States. Whatever repugnance I might have felt at the commission of this fresh crime was drowned in the selfish necessity of self-preservation. My plans were soon matured, and I hastened to put them in a proper train. I first loaded the old duck gun with ball, and putting it behind the door of the harness house, I went into the parlour. I found the captain lying on the sofa reading, his hat and gloves beside him on the table. He started up as I entered. "Is the horse ready?" "Not yet, sir. Some person has been in during the night and cut your new English saddle almost to pieces. I wish you could step out and look at it. I cannot put it on Charlie in its present state." "Don't bother me," he cried angrily. "It is in your charge. Blank you are answerable for that. Who the devil would think it worth their while to break into the harness house, to cut a saddle, when they could have carried it off entirely? Let me have none of your tricks, sir. You must have done it yourself." "That is not very likely, Captain Kinnaird. At any rate, it would be a satisfaction to me if you would come and look at it." "I'm in too great a hurry. Put on the old one." I still held the door in my hand. "It's only a step from here to the harness house." He rose reluctantly and followed me into the kitchen. The harness house formed part of a lean-to off the kitchen, and you went down two steps into it. He went on before me, and as he descended the steps, I clutched the gun I had left behind the door, took my aim between his shoulders, and shot him through the heart. He staggered forward and fell, exclaiming as he did so, "Oh God, I am shot!" In a few minutes he was lying in the cellar beside our other victim. Very little blood flowed from the wound. He bled internally. He had on a very fine shirt, and after rifling his person and possessing myself of his pocketbook, I took off his shirt and put on the one I had bought off the peddler. "Then," cried Mr. Mackey, to whom this confession was made, "that was how the peddler was supposed to have had a hand in the murder. That circumstance confused the evidence and nearly saved your life." "It was just as I have told you," said McDermott. "And tell me, McDermott, the reason of another circumstance that puzzled the whole court. How came that magazine which was found in the housekeeper's bed, saturated with blood, in that place and so far from the spot where the murder was committed?" "That too is easily explained, though it was such a riddle to you gentlemen of the law. When the captain came out to look at the saddle, he had the book open in his hand. When he was shot, he clapped the book to his breast with both his hands. Almost all the blood that flowed from it was caught in that book. It required some force on my part to take it from his grasp after he was dead. Not knowing what to do with it, I flung it into the housekeeper's bed, while I harnessed the riding horse into his new buggy. Grace collected all the valuables in the house. You know, sir, that we got safe on board the steamer at Toronto, but, owing to an unfortunate delay, we were apprehended, sent to jail, and condemned to die. Grace, you tell me, has been reprieved, and her sentence commuted into confinement in the penitentiary for life. This seems very unjust to me, for she is certainly more criminal than I am. If she had not instigated me to commit the murder, it would never have been done. But the priest tells me that I shall not be hung, and not to make myself uneasy on that score." "McDermott," said Mr. Mackey, "it is useless to flatter you with false hopes. You will suffer the execution of your sentence tomorrow at 8 o'clock, in front of the jail. I have seen the order sent by the governor to the sheriff, and that was my reason for visiting you tonight. I was not satisfied in my own mind of your guilt. What you have told me has greatly relieved my mind, and I must add, if ever man deserved his sentence, you do yours." When this unhappy man was really convinced that I was in earnest, that he must pay with his life for the penalty of his crime, continued Mr. Mackey, his abject cowardice and the mental agonies he endured were too terrible to witness. He dashed himself on the floor of his cell, and shrieked and raved like a maniac, declaring that he could not and would not die, that the law had no right to murder a man's soul as well as his body, by giving him no time for repentance, that if he was hung like a dog, Grace Marks, in justice, ought to share his fate. Finding all that I could say to him had no effect in producing a better frame of mind, I called in the chaplain, and left the sinner to his fate. A few months ago I visited the penitentiary, and as my pleading had been the means of saving Grace from the same doom, I naturally felt interested in her present state. I was permitted to see and speak to her, and Mrs. M., I shall never forget the painful feelings I experienced during this interview. She had been 5 years in the penitentiary, but still retained a remarkably youthful appearance. The sullen assurance that had formerly marked her countenance had given place to a sad and humbled expression. She had lost much of her former good looks, and seldom raised her eyes from the ground. "Well, Grace," said I, "how is it with you now?"
"Bad enough, sir," she answered with a sigh. "I ought to feel grateful to you for all the trouble you took on my account. I thought you my friend then, but you were the worst enemy I ever had in my life."
"How is that, Grace?"
"Oh, sir, it would have been better for me to have died with McDermott than to have suffered for years as I have done. The torments of the damned. Oh, sir, my misery is too great for words to describe. I would gladly submit to the most painful death if I thought that it would put an end to the pangs I daily endure. But though I have repented of my wickedness with bitter tears, it has pleased God that I should never again know a moment's peace. Since I helped McDermott to strangle Hannah Montgomery, her terrible face and those horrible bloodshot eyes have never left me for a moment. They glare upon me by night and day, and when I close my eyes in despair, I see them looking into my soul. It is impossible to shut them out. If I am at work, in a few minutes that dreadful head is in my lap. If I look up to get rid of it, I see it in the far corner of the room. At dinner, it is in my plate, or grinning between the persons who sit opposite to me at table. Every object that meets my sight takes the same dreadful form. And at night, in the silence and the loneliness of my cell, those blazing eyes make my prison as light as day. No, not as day. They have a terribly hot glare that has not the appearance of anything in this world. And when I sleep, that face hovers above my own, its eyes just opposite to mine, so that when I awake with a shriek of agony, I find them there. Oh, this is hell, sir. These are the torments of the damned. Were I in that fiery place, my punishment could not be greater than this." The poor creature turned away, and I left her, for who could say a word of comfort to such grief? It was a matter solely between her own conscience and God. Having heard this terrible narrative, I was very anxious to behold this unhappy victim of remorse. She passed me on the stairs as I proceeded to the part of the building where the women were kept. But on perceiving a stranger, she turned her head away, so that I could not get a glimpse of her face. Having made known my wishes to the matron, she very kindly called her in to perform some trifling duty in the ward, so that I might have an opportunity of seeing her. She is a middle-sized woman, with a slight, graceful figure. There is an air of hopeless melancholy in her face, which is very painful to contemplate. Her complexion is fair, and must, before the touch of hopeless sorrow paled it, have been very brilliant. Her eyes are a bright blue, her hair auburn, and her face would be rather handsome were it not for the long, curved chin, which gives, as it always does to most persons who have this facial defect, a cunning, cruel expression. Grace Marks glances at you with a sidelong, stealthy look. Her eye never meets yours, and after a furtive regard, it invariably bends its gaze upon the ground. She looks like a person rather above her humble station, and her conduct during her stay in the penitentiary was so unexceptionable that a petition was signed by all the influential gentlemen in Kingston, which released her from her long imprisonment. She entered the service of the governor of the penitentiary, but the fearful hauntings of her brain have terminated in madness. She is now in the asylum at Toronto, and as I mean to visit it when there, I may chance to see this remarkable criminal again. Let us hope that all her previous guilt may be attributed to the incipient workings of this frightful malady.
To the wind. Stern spirit of air, wild voice of the sky, thy shout rends the heavens, and earth trembles with dread. In hoarse, hollow murmurs the billows reply, and ocean is roused in his cavernous bed. On thy broad rushing pinions destruction rides free, unfettered they sweep the wild deserts of air. The hurricane bursts over mountain and sea, and havoc and death mark thy track with despair. When the thunder lies cradled within its dark cloud, and earth and her tribes crouch in silence and dread, thy voice shakes the forest, the tall oak is bowed, that for ages had shook at the tempest his head. when the Lord bowed the heavens and came down in his might, sublimely around were the elements cast. At his feet lay the dense rolling shadows of night, but the power of omnipotence rode on the blast. From the whirlwind he spake, where man wrung with pain, in the strength of his anguish dare challenge his God. Mid its thunders he told him his reasoning was vain, till he bowed to correction and kissed the just rod. When called by the voice of the prophet of old, in the valley of bones to breathe over the dead, like the sands of the sea could their number be told, they started to life when the mandate had sped. Those chill mouldering ashes thy summons could bind, and the dark icy slumbers of ages gave way. The spirit of life took the wings of the wind, rekindling the souls of the children of clay. Shrill trumpet of God, I shrink at thy blast, that shakes the firm hills to their centre with dread, and have thought in that conflict, earth's saddest and last, that thy deep chilling sigh will awaken the dead.
End of chapter 10.